The Hayes Advantage with Kathleen Hayes.
Very pleased to introduce now, certainly my star guest of the day. Jim Bullard is president of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, a term he started serving on March 1st, 2011. I can't believe it was that recently.
No, 2008.
Oh, 2008. Excuse me.
Yeah.
But this is your second term. Yeah, I know, because I was there. I was there. It was your first interview in 2000. That's what it was. Because you were right in the middle of the crisis, right? And there you were taking over.
It was right after Bear Stearns.
I know. You had good timing, Jim.
Yeah, as soon as I came in, everything went downhill.
Yeah, how'd you manage that? At any rate. And by now, you must feel like such a veteran. I mean, you'd been at the St. Louis Fed for so many years doing research and well-respected for all your monetary acumen, your academic papers, which is why you're such a perfect fit for the St. Louis Fed. But being the president of the bank, being at the FOMC making those decisions takes it to a whole other level, doesn't it?
It is different than being on the research staff, although I will say right from the beginning of the time I was on the research staff, I was pretty closely involved with monetary policy and with FOMC matters. So I do have a lot of background and experience on that dimension. So it wasn't a complete surprise to me as to how the committee works or how the staff works and so on.
Of course. But you do have that. You're at the head of the pack now. And it's interesting, too. I remember when we talked back then, you, at that time, thought the economy was going to get through things okay, as I recall. The forecast was for withstanding. Of course,
I would say in 2008, in the summer of 2008, I was too optimistic at the time. But I don't think anybody really, at the time, really envisioned what happened with Lehman. And it's not really Lehman. It's really AIG because I don't think Lehman by itself would have been such a big problem, but it was the AIG right behind it that really started the crisis.
Okay. Well, you see 3.5% growth next year. Am I correct? 3 to 3.5?
That's what I said this morning. Yeah.
Ah, gotcha. No, you did. I was in the audience listening because he spoke to Bloomberg managing editor Matt Winkler at the summit. And
I do think there's this tail risk that's in there with the European sovereign debt crisis, and so when I'm saying 3 to 3.5, I'm saying that
absent.
the tail doesn't occur, you know, but that tail risk is in there, and you have to think about that.
Why are you betting the tail risk won't occur?
Sorry?
Why are you still, you're acknowledging the chance that could happen, but it seems to me, or I should ask you, are you betting that that's a tail risk and that's what's going to happen?
I don't think that's the most likely outcome. It's not even a very probable outcome, so I don't think you should have that be dragging down your forecast. So I think you should just acknowledge that there's some tail risk and make the forecast. So I think the economy will improve some next year, barring catastrophe in Europe.
Did the actions taken by the Fed, European Central Bank, and four other central banks to provide cheaper dollar funding basically in Europe, so to get to the banks, is that going to prevent the meltdown from happening?
I think it's a backstop. It's intended as a backstop. This dollar funding has been very important in Europe. The fact that the Fed used these dollar swaps with the ECB during the 2008-2009 crisis was cited by Jean-Claude Trichet as a decisive factor in getting through that episode. So I do think this is a very important issue for the Europeans. And, you know, we are charging a penalty rate on that. And I think that's important because it keeps the European banks from using the swap lines inappropriately. But still, they can access liquidity should it come to that.
What's an inappropriate use of them?
Well, I think inappropriately would mean on a continuous basis and without any end in sight, and use it as sort of ordinary funding. It's only intended to provide a backstop in the event of a very serious liquidity shortage. And I will say also, right now, those are not being tapped very extensively. I haven't seen the last, you know, up to now anyway. They haven't been tapped very extensively, and so we're not really seeing the same level of usage that we saw in 2008 and 2009, at least not so far.
Now, the swap line arrangement states that it lowers the cost for swap users, ultimately the banks, extends the period over which the swaps facilities will be available. The announcement also said it, quote, enhanced the capacity to provide liquidity support to the global financial system. Is that basically a broadening in the usage of swap facilities?
I don't think so. I would envision them as working much as they have in the past, and it does broaden them in the sense that we have reciprocal agreements with all five of these central banks in a way that we didn't before, but it's not anticipated that you would need, let's say, yen funding in the U.S. or Canadian dollar funding in the U.S. So, but still, we have them there if something should happen that's unforeseen.
Have the amounts that have been made available become larger?
Not in this statement. As far as I know, the amounts are similar to what they've been in the past.
Is it still a liquidity facility support lending for the banks, or could the ECB, for example, use it as a source of outright funding to help support weakened European bond markets?
No, it's meant as dollar funding for the banks. So the banks will come to the ECB wanting to borrow dollars instead of euros, and this is a way to do that.
If someone says to you, like me, Jim, are you bailing out Europe? What do you say?
No, I wouldn't see this as a bailout for Europe. I would just see this as a way to get through any liquidity crisis that we might have associated with the sovereign debt crisis. And as I say, you know, right now we're not really to that stage yet, so this is really a backstop against that possibility. But, you know, we're not really there yet, but I think the central banks wanted to take this as a precautionary measure.
At this time next year, will the Eurozone still be using the euro currency? To participate, text the word GO to 36500. GO to 36500. The poll closes at 2:45 and we'll have the results shortly. So since I asked that question, let's don't wait for you to text. What do you think? Will is the euro going to hold together through all this? Or are we going to see a country or two jettisoned and a slightly different euro down the road?
You know, a lot of people will talk about, you know, forcing somebody out of the eurozone or, you know, forcing a country to not use the euro, but it doesn't really make that much sense. A country outside the eurozone could still use the euro. There's countries that are outside the U.S. that use the dollar, for instance. They become dollarized. So you could do the same thing if you were outside the eurozone. You weren't an official member, but you could still be a euro-using country, and you could denominate all your debt in euros and so on. So it doesn't really make that much sense to say, I'm going to kick you out of the euro. That's something that's often said, but it doesn't make that much sense.
Well, someone might just want to exit. I mean, wouldn't it be easier for Greece in some ways if it had its own currency again?
They could exit, and they could return. They could return to their own currency. The Greeks could return to the drachma. But that doesn't make that much sense either, because the whole reason they got rid of the drachma was to get the credibility that was behind the euro so that there wouldn't be an inflation risk premium when they went out to borrow on international capital markets. So to return to some weaker currency like that and allow the Greek central bank to run the monetary policy, markets are going to be suspicious, initially at least, of how well the bank is going to do and whether the bank is going to devalue and so on. And this is going to put an extra risk premium into the yields that the Greeks would have to pay on international capital markets. So it doesn't make that much sense to say, well, I'm just going to go and devalue. Markets see that, and as part of the equilibrium that that risk premium would be in there. So I think the discussion hasn't really been as sophisticated as it needs to be about what would happen if you return to your own currency.
Well, how about this? A very simple discussion. Latin American debt restructuring. It took a while in the 80s. It got done. And in fact, now those countries have some of the best budget, you know, debt to GDP ratios in the world, right? It seems that Europe has gone now more to this side of guaranteeing bank debt and perhaps buying European sovereign bonds. And some people say, well, wait, where are the losses on unsecured creditors? Where's the shared pain here and the market discipline if Europe goes down that road?
Yeah, a lot of the response to the crisis has been that there's too much debt, but nevertheless, we're going to introduce even more debt to try to get through a rough patch, and then in the future, we'll be able to pay off our debt. And that doesn't seem like the right response. You've got too many countries that have borrowed too much and are spending too much, and they have to find ways to get to more austerity, get lower budget deficits, and work their debt down. And that's where the the central response of the crisis has to be on the politicians to actually make those tough decisions and get that process going.
You've talked about the tail risk from Europe. You don't think it's the most probable outcome. What about how exposed U.S. banks might be to European banks? Is it serious exposure?
I think we're in much better shape than we were in 2008 and 2009 on this question. Our banks have better capital levels and better liquidity management. I think there's only limited exposure to direct exposure to European sovereign debt. Plus, you've got other ways to use derivatives to slough off risk from sovereign debt through the CDS market. So I think there's... I think the banks themselves have a lot more incentive to manage their risk, and they're being very careful about this. And so for this reason, I do think we're in better shape. I do think there's a certain amount of irreducible risk or irreducible uncertainty that no one can really be sure exactly where all the risk is, but I think we're much farther along than we were in 2008 and 2009.
I'm so glad you mentioned the credit default swaps, because... Yeah. In the Greek episode, many say Greece defaulted, but it wasn't treated as a credit event. The banks have to take at least a 50% haircut. As someone said earlier today at this summit, how ironic that the Western Europe, the heart of contract law, so quickly just turned over contract law in the face of credit default swaps. Why would anybody think that their credit default swaps on sovereign bonds in Europe are going to pay now?
Well, I think this is a great issue, but this shows that you have to be very careful if you're going to enter into these kinds of agreements as to how they're going to be enforced in court and how they're going to be used.
Is the Fed assuming that they're going to pay? That the banks will get that protection on their sovereign bonds they're holding? That those will be honored?
I don't think the Fed has an official position on that question. As far as I know.
What about the U.S. Stress test coming up? What they're going to assume, you're going to stress against unemployment going to 13%, a much weaker economy, GDP falling by 8%. There's two groups out there. I think some say, great, let's make sure the banks could withstand another very sort of 100-year perfect storm event. Others saying, oh my gosh, you're already asking them to hold more capital. Banks have many challenges they're facing, and this is just going to slow the economy and be a real headwind for not only the banks but growth more broadly.
No, I think that we're especially for these very large banks, we're still living in the too big to fail era, and unfortunately, and I think for that reason we have to be sure to stress test these banks to make sure that they can survive another downturn if there was another downturn. Make sure that taxpayers won't be asked to bail these guys out in the event that the economy doesn't perform as well as we'd like. So I think it's a prudent measure to go through the stress test exercise, and we have had some good results over the last couple of years by taking on this as an explicit exercise.
So I want to get back to the U.S. economy, Jim, because I know, and you've said it a couple of times today, nevertheless, that you see the economy growing about by as much as 3.5% next year, right?
Yeah, I think the news has been better for the second half of the year. The holiday season looks reasonably good so far, and we'll have to see how that develops. And I think it's reasonable to expect that the economy will pick up steam in the first half of 2012. But as we've been talking about, we do have this tail risk out there about what's going to happen in Europe.
And of course, the retail, the chain store sales out today, retailers from Macy's to Costco reporting monthly revenues at stores open at least a year that beat Wall Street estimates. That certainly was a positive report. The ADP employment numbers yesterday showing private sector companies adding 206,000 jobs. And of course, Macroeconomic Advisors is out there in St. Louis with you. But there's a lot of people, it seems. You could look at Merrill Lynch. I'm trying to think who else right off the top of my head who see a stronger fourth quarter. And maybe it could even be something more like 3%. But they say that when you get out into next year, there's nothing keeping the momentum going, that the growth is going to drop back below 2%, maybe 1.5%. What is going to accelerate growth? What's going to keep it there? Why do you see that?
Yeah, I'm not sure. That isn't the most natural forecast to have. Normally, you'd think if the economy was improving that it would continue to improve and grow around a trend pace of growth. And I think what a lot of people have in mind is maybe that the fiscal situation will come to, you know, maybe detract from growth in the first half of 2012. But I don't really see that as the most likely outcome. Sounds to me like this payroll tax will be extended. I mean, I don't have any inside scoop on that, but that's just reading the tea leaves from the politicians. It sounds to me like that'll get passed, and I'm not sure what else they'll do, but they'll do some things toward the end of the year here that'll probably not make it so there's an abrupt end to the payroll tax.
You have you said today that you are not at this time in favor of more long-term asset purchases, more bond purchases, more quantitative easing. Is that right?
Well, I think we took some easing actions in the summer at the July meeting, the August meeting. We've got our Operation Twist that's still going on and will continue to go on through the next 6 months. And the data has been better on the economy. It looks like the fourth quarter will be, you know, reasonably strong. So for all those reasons, I think it's a good time to sort of gather information. Also, you want to find out what's going to happen in Europe, how this is going to play out. And then we can make a decision after that.
Can the economy improve? Can it get up to this, say, 3.5% growth rate next year if house prices are still falling, if the housing market is still weak? It seems to me, Jim, among the camp that says, you know what, maybe we're doing better now, next year is still going to look pretty soggy, that's one of the main arguments they put out there.
I'm saying 3.5%, and I don't expect very much out of the housing sector, so I would expect that to continue to be very sluggish. And I have been disappointed, and so now I don't have much of a prediction for growth there. I would have expected housing to have improved this year, and it didn't really improve this year. Maybe next year will be our year, but I'm not counting on it. So we'll have to see.
What indicators should the Fed be focusing on right now? What are the most important things to gauge where we are and where we're going?
Well, as always, we look at everything in the total economy. I think it doesn't make sense to just look at one little piece of the economy. So we try to assess the entire economy, and it's getting more complicated over time as there's more global interactions, and certainly the rise of Asia is really complicating how we're thinking about the U.S. economy. So there's many facets to it. We do care about labor markets, we do care about financial stability, we do care about manufacturing, we care about agriculture, so we're trying to fit all the pieces together in a sensible whole.
Okay, here's something that's puzzling to me. The Fed has pledged to keep rates low, perhaps until the middle of 2013, and in fact there's a discussion we learned from the last Fed minutes about being more developing that what you call communication policy tool, correct? But if you have growth at 3.5%, and if it continues there, why would that argue for, does that argue, I should say, for keeping the funds rate at zero for as much as 2 years? Are we waiting for unemployment to come down? What's the indicator for the Fed to confirm that it will keep that rate low, or to say, well, gosh, I guess we better change that part of our communication policy?
Well, we'd certainly are worried about labor markets. Unemployment has been high, and the duration of unemployment is as high as it's ever been in the U.S. This means that you've got unemployed workers who are whose skills are atrophying, hurting our human capital as a nation, and so this is a serious problem. We'd like to see that improve. We did get the ADP report, as you were just saying. That was a little bit better yesterday. Maybe we'll get a good jobs report tomorrow. I don't know. We'll have to see what that comes out to be. But we're definitely watching labor markets. It is an important component. We're also watching inflation. Inflation is higher now than it was a year ago. It is moderating, but it really hasn't moderated all that much yet. And so I'd like to see further evidence that inflation is going to moderate. So we have to weigh all these things and put them together and hopefully make a good decision for the
nation.
It
sounds to me like this is an extremely subjective policy, because there's no one indicator, there's no one target. It's as though the Fed says, well, when we sense the economy is strong enough to withstand higher rates, we'll move that rate up. Or is this really a pledge that almost no matter what happens, the key rate stays low for the next 2 years?
No, I think the language in the statement does say that we're, you know, keeping an eye on developments in the economy, and we'll make a decision based on that. So the committee does retain the ability to change this date. As you know, I didn't really favor putting this date in the statement in the first place because I think it does tend to get frozen there, and then it tends to be hard for the committee to react to incoming data and change the date around. And so for that reason, I'd rather not talk in those terms. So the committee will review this going forward, see what we think about if there's better ways that we can communicate with markets about what our intentions are.
The dual mandate, recently a lot of Fed officials, or some I should say, particularly Charles Evan from the Chicago Fed, one of your colleagues in the district almost next door to yours.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he even said in a speech recently he is a little bit on the extreme, that other extreme end at the Fed, but arguing in fact that perhaps there should be more steps taken until an unemployment gets to as low as 7%, and you could see inflation as high as 3% or more. Janet Yellen, the Fed vice chair, recently giving a speech suggesting there's more the Fed can do. She didn't really exactly say, I think we should do it now, but I think the markets really took her speech as indicating that she's ready to do more. You don't agree with that. Why?
Well, I think if we were going to take more action, the economy would have to deteriorate further from where it is today. As I said, I mean, that we already took easing actions in July and August, and then the data came in stronger than expected during the fall. So that isn't the most natural time to ease further. Now, on this idea of staying at zero until the unemployment rate comes down to a sufficiently low level, I've argued against that, and one of the reasons I'm against that is that European unemployment over the last three decades has been miserable because there's been hysteresis effects in many European countries. So unemployment just went up in the early 80s, and then it stayed high. It didn't seem to move around very much in response to business cycles in the various countries, and so you just had high unemployment for a long time. So I'd be adverse to tying the policy rate numerically to what the unemployment rate is, because it's just not clear at this point what's going to happen to unemployment going forward. I hope and do think that the unemployment rate will come down to a more natural level as it has in the past in the U.S., but you have to be, as a policymaker, you have to be aware of the possibility that we've got some new era upon us, as has been experienced in Europe, that unemployment will stay high, that these long-duration unemployed workers will have a lot of trouble finding jobs going forward. And if that's the situation, that would be a bad situation, but I would not want to have monetary policy then numerically tied to the unemployment rate, because that could pull monetary policy off course for a generation.
Quick question from a listener who is very concerned about what's going to happen to yields on government bonds. What is the prospect will be overtaken by the sheer weight of the debt before our elected officials are willing to act? Will uncontrollable interest rate increases be the proximate cause of a promised debt-related financial crisis in the United States? Are you concerned about that, Jim?
I am concerned about this. This is a great question from the listener. I think American policymakers are not as do not have the sense of urgency that they should have about the U.S. debt and deficit situation. Obviously, there's been a lot of talk about it, but not too much action. And the Italian situation really shows you how fast markets can turn on a country. This is Italy was a AAA country. For years they've had high debt. If you just looked at the historical record, you might conclude that Italy would always be able to borrow at a very low rate. But one day they woke up and it turned out that markets had turned on them. Their rates are very high and now their situation's looking unsustainable. They're in the middle of a crisis. That could happen in the U.S. and we have to be prepared for that possibility.
Jim Bullard, thank you very much. I didn't even congratulate you on the Cards.
Oh.
Winning this series. It's old news, but definitely.
No, we're so proud of the team.
Listen to the Hayes Advantage weekdays at noon Eastern on Bloomberg 1130 in New York or on Sirius and XM Satellite Radio Channel 113. Copyright 2011, Bloomberg LP.
Really, really a great year.